Hello there again, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 23rd of June, the year 2000, and in the fireside room this morning, the Bible study with Rabbi Robert Marks continues, and it's clearing away in the wilderness, dealing with some of the thorny texts of the Bible, is the title. And this is tape number MXR 2000-4. So let's join Rabbi Mark for this presentation.
Hi, Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu L'asok B'divrei Torah. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who has sanctified us by thy commandments and commanded us to study thy word. Amen.
Amen.
Welcome, everyone. I'm going to deal with one of the most difficult passages of the whole Bible today, one of the most troublesome. And yet, paradoxically, it is going to be a passage which, in my opinion, draws the distinction between Judaism and Christianity more clearly than perhaps any other passage in the whole Bible. And I hope by the end of the hour, both to do that in a way that won't be offensive to either of our traditions, because we're dealing with a passage that is so terribly, terribly difficult for any rational human being, any parent, anyone who's ever had a child. And that's the story of the Akedah. It's usually translated the sacrifice of Isaac. It is, Akedah means the offering, the burnt offering of Isaac. Not the killing of Isaac, but the burnt offering of Isaac. They're extra copies. Elizabeth, if you would take these, and you're stationed by the door, if you would not mind giving them to people who came in late, I would very much be in your debt. I also have copies of a feminist analysis of the early part of Genesis, and if anyone is interested in this, I'm not going to, unfortunately, I intended to deal with it 2 days ago, and lost it in my suitcase until today, so you're welcome to take that too, which is characteristic of how well organized I am in my professional life. I once went to services and forgot my sermon. And it was only Yom Kippur. The holiest day of the year. Gave the best sermon I've ever given in my whole life, which was a very bad lesson for me, because it sort of suggested maybe I should never write my sermons out in the future. Amen. I can hear Joel is a preacher up there. I can. Now, the passage we're about to read is so terribly painful, and yet the story of the Akedah, the story of Isaac and Abraham, is the passage that we read on Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the year, one of the holiest days in the Jewish calendar. It is the story that somehow or other continually attracts us and draws us to it. I want you to know that I have now been a rabbi for 49 years. And I preached about 5 years before that as a student rabbi, a student at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, where they would send me to such famous places as Pascagoula, Mississippi. Muncie, Indiana. And the best one of all was Laredo, Texas. That was fun. And this is the text every Rosh Hashanah morning, because this is the passage that we read. Now, I have to ask the question for all of us, why? Why is this passage read? Why is it read in the synagogue? What does it mean for Christians and Jews alike? I mean, how can we say this is an important passage, and what can we draw from it? What the best thing for us to do is to start reading it. If you will, please turn to chapter 22 of the book of Genesis. Chapter 22 of the book of Genesis. I'm going to ask somebody to start reading. Are there enough copies of this text for everyone? I hope there are. You will need a Bible today, so if you will, get chapter 22 of Genesis.
the first verse.
Right, begin.
Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, he replied. Then God said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about.
All right, now I want to pause for just a minute to note the parallelism in the Bible. When we first meet Abraham in chapter 12 of Genesis, well, keep your fingers here, can you? And go back to chapter 12 of Genesis. Just chapter 12. You'll see something interesting. Mark, you can read too. Just the first verse.
Okay, hold on.
But keep your place here because you're going to read it.
The Lord had said to Abram, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you.
All right. Interesting. Look at how the passage here says, look at the trilogy. Abraham is told, leave, I'm going to do my translation. Leave your country, your kindred, your father's house. Country, kindred, father's house. The rabbi's comment, why doesn't it just say, get you out of where you are and go to the land of Israel? Why does it have to say all of this stuff, okay? Because, say the commentaries, it shows, whenever it does this, it's showing how painful it is. Because Abraham has to make a threefold separation. He's not only leaving his country, he's leaving his family. He's leaving the place that he knows so well, his father's house. There's a threefold of anxiety that is developed here. But now notice the parallelism. Now you can lose chapter 12 because we've already done that. Let's now go back to 22. Notice in the first verse I have said lose it and I've lost it, okay? So chapter 22. Take thy son, thy only son, whom thou lovest, even Isaac. Do you see what it's doing here too? The same parallelism repeated. How painful it is. How painful this is going to be. Take your son, your only son. Now, was it Abraham's only son?
No,
it wasn't, was it? He has another son, Ishmael. So that's something to keep in mind. Why does it say thy only son here? But he has another son, Ishmael. And Abraham has to take him now. The painfulness of what he's trying to do is emphasized by this threefold statement, your son, your only son, the one you love. And now Isaac. One other parallelism, and I'm sorry I told you to leave 12 so quickly, it says, go to the land that I will show you. It's indefinite. There's no place certain. Now read here, and get thee to the land of Moriah, and offering him upon one of the places which I will tell thee of. In other words, go to the state of Washington, and when you get there, I'll tell you how to get up to, which probably is good advice. Get her first. I mean, you've got to get her first. Got to get her first, and then God somehow or other gets you here. At least that's how I felt about it. You know, it's never certain. My luggage, maybe it feels point landing, right? All right, go ahead, please.
Early the next morning, Abraham got up and saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, Father, Yes, my son, Abraham replied. The fire and the wood are here, Isaac said. But where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. When they reached
You could, instead of like preachers that are here, you could give a whole sermon, the two of them went on together. It's a beautiful passage about parents and children. It's so, you know, to go on together has all sorts of sermonic implications. We go on with our children in so many ways. We move ahead with them. We go on, if we can go on together, that's such a, I mean, that in itself, if you're interested in sermonics, it is just such a beautiful opportunity to talk about what it means for parents and children to go on together, all the difficulties sometimes we face, all the problems in relationships, all of the health problems we can face together, all of the financial and living and housing problems, to go on together, to go past where you were, is a passage that you could get stuck on this, and some Rosh Hashanahs I do. I don't go beyond this point because it's a beautiful plot. And the idea they went on together is repeated at the end of the story, as you'll see. So sermonically, it ends, we go on together and we face the difficult crisis, and then we go on together when we come back from the crisis, and that's lovely too. Okay, go ahead.
When they reached the place God had told them about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar, on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son.
Now, I must tell you, every time I read this, I tremble. On the high holidays, I just tremble. Because what a horrible, powerful, frightening, awesome moment it is to have to, you see that hand. Now, do you tell this story to your religious school children? How does it fit with Noah and the Ark, okay? But you know, Noah and the Ark is a pretty scary story too, if you ever stop to think about it. Who was it that suggested to me the other day, what about all those people that wanted to get on the ark? Mm-hmm. Stop and think about that.
Kind of,
we don't tell that story to children, do we? We don't deal with it. But this story, we're reading in our synagogues on Rosh Hashanah morning. And I always, I read it rather, you know, my assistant Chance, and I read because I by Yishlach Avraham et Yado Lishchot et Beno, and I hold my hand up like this, and my hand shakes as I tell a story because it's so overwhelmingly awesome and awful. Awful and awesome. Go ahead.
But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Here I am, he replied. Do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, the Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand in the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and though through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed, because you have obeyed me. Then Abraham returned to his servants, and they set off together for Beersheba, and Abraham stayed in Beersheba.
And they went together. Again, you see the repetition of they went together at the beginning, and they went together at the end. Only there's a very important little thing here, which we're going to get to in a minute. How do you deal with this story? You people, if you're preachers, how do you deal, or do you deal with it? I mean, is this a topic you avoid, this subject? You don't. Joel, tell us. How do you deal with it?
Well, I think you deal with the notion that it's just hard to imagine the kind of faith that people trust.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the focus of addressing the trust. And you already said it. It's unimaginable.
Unimaginable.
In that position. Mm-hmm.
Now, I must tell you, someone at the first hour said something that I had rather expected to hear last night. And that is, this is the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Hmm. Because here there's a God of vengeance and punishment, and in the New Testament there's a God of love. Well, you know, with all due respect, I just feel that's the old stereotype that isn't very helpful, and that also misses the use of this text in dealing with a lot of things. So you deal with it that way. I don't want to limit this to clergy people, because I think the nature of this village is that everyone is equal here. So don't let me, the fact that I asked for some sermonic uses, don't let that scare you. Yes.
Rob. I had a rabbi explain this this way, and it's a couple years ago. I hated this text until then. That it was a story of God's love and grace to continue to give Abraham this heritage, in spite of the fact that Abraham obeyed this ridiculous command after a series of arguing with God. I mean, Sodom and Gomorrah was right before this, and Abraham said, wait a minute, God, let's talk about your plan here, and argued God down to how much destruction would happen there. So you have this faithful servant who was faithful to this God, and who that God was, not what commands came down through the pipe. And then here we get a story where the command comes down through the pipe. It's a ridiculous command, and Abraham doesn't argue. He says, oh, okay, I'll go kill my son.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that in the Sodom and Gomorrah story, that's a marvelous interpretation. I mean, but I got to tell you, I've been giving 54 of them, and that would be number 33 on the list. Because, no, I'm not saying that demeaningly. I'm just saying that there are so many different ways of dealing with this that can be exciting. But isn't it interesting that in the Sodom and Gomorrah story, Abraham argues with God. Oh, God, if there are 50 people, save the city. There are 30 people. What about if there are 20? What about if there are 10? And finally, God walks away. He, you know, he's had enough of this bargain. Yeah. But here, his own son, he doesn't say a word. That's scary. Are those 50 people more important? 50 strangers in a terribly corrupt city, and they're in Las Vegas all the time. I mean, are they better and worth arguing about? But Abraham doesn't argue here at all. Let's see. Yes.
Tom. Well, that's even more interesting in light of the first line. You know, after these things, God tested Abraham. Now, you wonder if Abraham didn't know what God was up to.
Uh-huh.
He says, God will provide the lamb for me.
Well, you're talking like a rabbi now.
I haven't played too much chess before.
Yes, Gladys.
As they have said, God was testing Abraham's faith, and his faith was rewarded by God in that he established a covenant with Abraham that he would head the greatest of all nations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So also the fact that God comes first before anything,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or should in our lives, like a husband comes second. God comes first, then the husband, the wife is concerned, and vice versa. That should always be the case.
So this is the preeminence of God. Philip? Yeah.
I look at this and I wonder how old is Isaac?
How old what?
How old was his son, Isaac?
Aha. Well, I'm going to get to that a little later. It's a good question. Pick it's this. A very good question, and it's absolutely relevant to what I want to... Give me a few minutes, okay?
There's three people here. There's God, there's Isaac, and there's... Isaac's just...
Yeah, okay, and I'm going to suggest there's a fourth here, too, which... Okay, that's interesting. Yes, how old was I? Well, all right, let's just sum this up, though. How can one interpret this story? There's several ways that one can interpret it. One is that it was part of God's divine plan. You could do it that way, right? Elie Wiesel, somebody pointed out in the earlier session, and this was interesting to me. Elie Wiesel, a great writer, modern writer about the Holocaust, says that this is an indictment of God, that what has to come out of this is God seeking forgiveness for what he's done. Now, you have to understand, Elie Wiesel is a survivor of Auschwitz, of the Holocaust, and is a very God-fearing, God-believing man, but is angry at God. Can you do that? I guess you can. You can believe and be angry. I mean, that's something that people have... I think that gives us a little bit of freedom to be able to understand that one can be angry at God. And Wiesel says this is a story... The Holocaust, Elie Wiesel tells the story straight and says, this is, God is going to have to seek forgiveness for what he's done. Well, if you read Elie Wiesel's works and you know about Elie Wiesel, what he's saying is that God has to seek forgiveness for having allowed the Holocaust to happen. I mean, that's really what he's talking about. The 6 million to die. Now, I made a terrible mistake. I said 6 million, or in the earlier session, I said 6 million is a metaphor. It may not have been exactly 6 million. It may have been 5,700,000. But somebody heard me saying, it may be 5 million or 700,000. I did not say that. In other words, 6 million was not the exact figure. It becomes a metaphor for what we have as an exact count, probably of actual names on lists, is probably 576,000 names of people who died in the Holocaust. That's an awful number. But don't anyone please go away from here thinking I said it may have been 5 million or 700,000. That is not at all what I was saying. I'm simply saying that you round it off to 6 million, and that's a horrible number, and that serves as a symbol for the Holocaust. So we could say what Wiesel said. You could say it's justifying God. Kierkegaard, yeah. Lutheran, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Danish philosopher. Kierkegaard wrote a beautiful article, which I'm sure many of you read. Do you remember? Anybody remember the name of the article, the book he wrote? On the ontological suspension of the ethical, in which he deals with this story, the Abraham and Isaac story. And he says that this was Abraham ontologically suspending the ethical in terms of his faith. In other words, in terms of his whole being, there was the question of good and bad was not relevant. What God said was relevant. Now, here's what Kierkegaard does. There's a joke. I'm sorry. I got to tell the joke, and then I'll tell you the serious version of the joke because it illustrates this. The joke is, this comes over the internet, my major source of humor these days. Marvelous source of humor. That a man... is climbing a mountain. He's out here in the Cascades. It's dark, it's midnight, and he can't see where he's going. He trips and falls. Not a good idea to be there at midnight, is it? Trips and falls, and he plunges downward. Grabs the root of a tree, and he says, help me, is anyone there to help me? Please help me. And a booming voice yells out, my son, do you have faith? He says, yes, I have faith. Help me. My son, do you believe? Help me. This is the voice of God, my son. Do you believe? Yes. Let go. Is there anyone out there that can help me? Now, Kierkegaard tells that story seriously. A man falls and grabs hold of something, and it's dark, and he doesn't know how far down it is. And the question is, does he have enough faith to let go? See, that's the serious version. Does he have enough faith to let go, to listen to the voice of God, and to let go, and know that he'll be safe? So that's another way of telling the story. The sacrifice of Isaac is a problem, though. Now, I'm going to ask you this. What are some of the problems with this story that you see? Yes. Yes.
What can Isaac's relationship be with his father?
What can Isaac's relationship be with his father? Okay. What sort of a relationship? And you know, that's a good question. Because we know that Isaac is sort of a weak guy. I mean, what did this, you could deal with the story this way. What did that traumatic experience do to their relationship? See? What did it do to them? Well, Isaac wasn't the strongest man in the Bible, was he? Maybe this destroyed him. Maybe this father destroyed his son by that thing. I mean, you can imagine lying there with that upstretched arm over you, you know, traumatized for life. What could happen to him? So there was that, you see, that could be there. I want to ask you what's missing. How much? I got to always pace myself here. Yes.
No.
No, you're just looking at your watch. Yes.
Well, however old Isaac is, he doesn't have any record in Scripture of him returning his father to home.
Aha. Uh-huh. Look it. Now look it at the end here. Verse 19, chapter 22. Look at verse 19. It's Helen. It's Helen, right?
Carol.
Carol. I'm sorry, Carol. I'm seeing you in a haze. Carol, read verse 19 for me, will you?
So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham lived at Beersheba.
Now, there is a tradition that he didn't come back.
Yeah.
Look at that. It doesn't say Abraham and Isaac went on together. It says Abraham returned to his men. Now, that probably isn't true, but it's a midrashic possibility, isn't it? It's there as a midrashic possibility. What else is missing here? What do you see is missing?
I have a question that just occurred to me because now I'm reading this in New Revised Standard. I've done some looking into midrashic things and also some artwork about this. And there's a piece of mosaic that is pretty early that pictures the servant, one of the servants being female. This is,
oh, that's
important for the feminist view. That in some of the scriptures it doesn't say young men, it just says servants, and that there isn't a designation apparently of gender, maybe an assumption, and I'm wondering if RSV slipped into an error that wasn't there before.
Either. Well, I'm not aware of any midrashic commentary about the servants being women. The servants certainly aren't named here.
Well, no, that the mosaic even shows that there's, and it's from a synagogue, so it shows one male and one female.
Carol, we know of lots of traditions of early hermaphroditic behavior that men and women were interchangeable. Mm-hmm. You know, the tradition of Adam and Eve being created together as male and female, he created them. You know, that they were created as one. There is even a tradition, as you know, you who were here at the first session, there's even a tradition that God was both male and female. That I think some of this, and this is not my subject, but some of this has been suppressed by a male domination process that took place here and that we're just emerging from. I belong to a marvelous Catholic Jewish dialogue. that some of us created that's only secondary to the one that Jody and Ingrid and I participated in Chicago. But this is a Catholic-Jewish dialogue in which one of the topics one day was women in the priesthood, which is a very sore subject in the Catholic Church. One of the priests, I will not mention him, his name, one of the priests from Notre Dame came, and some of the traditional Catholics were very upset at him because he suggested that women should be priests. This was a Notre Dame professor who wanted women to be priests. And one of the comments, it was John McDermott at the time, said, women have never been priests. And the father answered by saying, women haven't been priests for 2,000 years, but 1,000 years are but as a moment in the eyes of God. Okay? So it can change. Now, there's one more tradition I want to mention before we do this, that I have to, because you're talking about ancient tradition. There is a tradition, too, that in ancient times, child sacrifice was practiced. Yeah. Now, this is when I was a young neophyte rabbi and knew everything. I mean, when I had just been ordained and knew absolutely everything, I used to give a sermon about this passage and say, well, this shows the effort to do away with child sacrifice because God tells Abraham, don't do that. So therefore, among primitive people who did sacrifice their children, this passage comes along to say, don't do it. Now, that was sort of interesting if I were an anthropologist, but I wonder what sermonic value that had to the mothers and fathers and little children who were sitting in my congregation at the time. I doubt that it had much influence on their child sacrifice practices. But in a sense, some parents do sacrifice their children. And one could give a sermon about that, about how we sacrifice our children by what we do, how we behave, how we treat them. And that's something else for us to think about. But in this story, in the story that we've just read, I have said that there are three characters so far, and I've suggested a fourth. The first, Abraham, second, Isaac, and the most important is calling the scenes, setting the scenario, is God. But there's a fourth. Well, the angel, yes. I should know. There's a fifth then. The angel and God, I think, are synonymous in my opinion.
The ram.
One could write a sermon about how that ram felt. I did that one year. I mean, why the ram instead of Isaac? I mean, poor ram. That ram, he was rambunctious. That had ramifications. I'm running rampant. Stop me while I'm still alive. What? I didn't hear that.
She was saying he wasn't looking where he's going and ended up in the thick of it.
Very good. That's very good. But who is missing?
Sarah.
Sarah's missing. Sarah. What about Sarah? Now, in order to deal with this, in order to understand my contention that this story can teach us more about the relationships of Judaism and Christianity in terms of where we differ, and maybe where we're alike, that any perhaps question that we dealt with yesterday in the discussion of what you'd like to know from a rabbi, let's turn to the chapter before this. Let's turn to chapter 21 of Genesis and read a little bit at the beginning. Somebody please read.
The Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did to Sarah as he had promised. And Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the time of which God had spoken to him. Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore him, Isaac. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him.
Now, just a little thing here. Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born, and the tradition has it that Isaac was 36 years old when he was sacrificed, or some say a little earlier. We'll see that in the Midrash. Now, Abraham was a pretty old guy to go traipsing around in those hills and binding his son.
Yeah.
Now, even if we allow for the biblical exaggeration, which I don't want to get hung up on, he was an elderly man at the time. We know that because earlier, a little bit earlier, when the angels, you remember, promised a son to Sarah, Abraham was well advanced. Abraham was supposed to be 90 years old at the time. Okay? There's a little discrepancy in time here, but we will allow for the biblical imagination to set its own time schedule. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
And Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh over me.
And you know, that's, you've got to, if you don't want to miss the biblical play on words, it's marvelous. Mm-hmm. The word Yitzchak is part of the root, tzachak, which means to laugh. Sarah, when she hears that she's going to bear a child, is hiding behind a curtain in the tent. And the angels come and say, Sarah, your wife is going to have a child in 9 months. Vatitzchak Sarah. Sarah laughed. Vatitzchak. And the name of their son is Yitzchak. He will laugh. And here it's like me and Rampant and Thicket and stuff like that. You can't let go. The Bible can't let go of this pun. So it says, because he brought me laughter, Yitzchak. Now, the same thing is true, as we've discovered, of Jacob, Yaakov. Yaakov means a heel. So Yaakov means he is a heel, or he will be a heel, because he followed on the heel of Esau, his brother. But again, the idea of going through life known as a heel is not a very appealing sort of a prospect. Go ahead.
And she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would suckle children, yet I have borne him a son in his old age? And the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, playing with her son Isaac. So she said to Abraham, cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac. And the thing was very displeasing to Abraham on account of his son. But God said to Abraham, Be not displeased because of the lad and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for through Isaac shall your descendants be named. And I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also, because he is your offspring.
And you know, traditionally, in both Judaism and Islam, Judaism branches out from Isaac, and Islam from Ishmael. And in the Quranic tradition, much is made of the common ancestry of both Jews and Muslims, both from Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac. Okay? Go ahead.
So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water and gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder along with the child, and sent her away. And she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water in the skin was gone, she cast the child under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down over against him a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot. For she said, let me not look upon the death of the child. And as she sat over against him, the child lifted up his voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him fast with your hand, for I will make him a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad to drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt.
Okay, what do you make of this story now? What do you think of the characters? Yes.
This story has troubled me ever since I was a little boy.
This course is on difficult passages of the Bible.
I couldn't understand why Abraham would send away his son.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now I'm older and so on. But it's troubled me ever since I was a little boy. I can remember being really troubled.
All right, you are troubled whenever, just remember this, whenever you are troubled, the commentators on the Bible are troubled too. And they have to make a commentary. Whenever any of you are troubled about this stuff, somebody else has been troubled by it before. And of course I'm troubled by it. Why do I read this passage? Well, you know, we can justify this in some way. I mean, that's one way of dealing with it. Not the best way, but it's one way of dealing with it. So how would we justify this passage of Abraham sending his child away? Take a look, and the commentary, the commentator has to look very hard to find a way to justify it. And he takes the word mitzachek, where in verse 9, take a look at verse 9. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had born unto Abraham, making sport, mitzachek. The Hebrew word is mitzachek. Now, mitzachek means to play lewdly. Okay? It has that meaning. So what the commentaries are saying is that Abraham and Sarah were worried that Ishmael would be a bad influence on Isaac. He had to send him away, you know, and I've heard of people that have had to be sent away from this place who have been problems, who have troubled the unity of the place. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm saying that's what the commentator said in answer to the worry you had. Listen to what my Chumash commentator says. And this is a commentary by Nachmanides, who is a 13th century Spanish Jewish thinker. Mitzache, the verb denotes idolatry. And he refers us to 2 Samuel verse 14, where the mitzachek is used for somebody who commits idolatry, or actually commits murder in that passage. Idolatry is in an Exodus passage. So the word mitzachek is connected up with other passages in which mitzachek has these evil uses. And in one it's idolatry, and one it's actual murder. So all of these passages, the same or a similar verb occurs. And in the last mention, the meaning is to fight to the death. Also, he quarreled with Isaac about the inheritance, claiming that he would be the heir as the eldest son. This follows from Sarah's insistence in the next verse that he should not be co-heir with Isaac. In pursuit of this quarrel, he went with Isaac into the field. And while pretending to engage in target practice, shot arrows. Isaac was shooting arrows into the air. Imagine playing target practice in 2000 BCE. But they were playing, shooting targets in the air. Ishmael, pretending to shoot targets into the air, shot targets at Isaac. Shot his arrows at Isaac. In other words, he was trying to kill Isaac. That's how they interpret it. Now, that's not going to satisfy us exactly, is it? I mean, it's a justification. But there's another deeper problem lying here. What do we think of this behavior? Yeah.
Well, another part of it is it seems to me that Sarah's jealousy of Hagar.
Sarah's jealousy of Hagar.
Yeah, it was her idea in the first place, and she's never been very happy. Yeah.
Sarah's jealous of Hagar? Sarah's behavior is not very good. I said before, one could say all of these families are dysfunctional families.
Well, Abraham yielded to that suggestion pretty quickly.
What, Carol? What?
I mean, Abraham yielded to that, to Hagar's suggestion.
Abraham yielded to it very quickly.
Without a fight, uh-huh. and I mean, it might have been nice of you that he would have said, oh, no, that's all right here.
Yeah, no, yeah. No, he didn't.
He tackled kindly to it. So, I mean, I think that Abraham, it appears to me that Abraham, if you look closely at these stories, Abraham becomes perhaps a weaker and weaker, we want to think of him as the great patriarch and all that. But
we want to think of him.
Yeah.
And indeed, the tradition wants to think of all of these guys as great. But the fact that there isn't, and I'm going to say this, I know I'm going to get into the fact that they are troubles Christians more than Jews. We're saying this is life. That these stories are to teach us about human weakness. That if we make them Jesus, we make a big mistake.
Yeah.
They are not in the Jewish imagination the Son of God. And they shouldn't be. They are our families, our troubled families,
yeah,
our searching families. They are bigger than life examples of it. You know, they may be exaggerations of what we go through, but they were, you know, how many kids have come home and say, I heard one of the kids the other day say, I'm afraid of my brother. He's going to come and beat me up. I mean, that's what Isaac and Ishmael are all about. You could, you know, that's not so strange to see that that's going on all around us. That there are those fears that people had. And Abraham and Sarah aren't communicating very well. Maybe a matter of age. Maybe Abraham didn't hear so well at the age of 120. I don't know. But he certainly wasn't involved in very good communication with Sarah. Because, what is missing from the story of the sacrifice? Sarah is missing. Now, one interpretation of this story is that it's the parallel of the Ishmael story. Ishmael has been sent away to die. Maybe God is telling Abraham, this is what it's like. This is what, you ever think of it that way? Marvelous way of doing it. This is what it's like, Abraham. Take your kid up in the mountain and do away with him and you'll see what it's like. That's one possible interpretation. Look for just a moment at, before you look, but turn to chapter 23, right after this. Genesis 23. But can you imagine Sarah waking up one morning and she finds a note on her dresser, have taken Isaac up to the mountain to sacrifice. See you at dinner on Wednesday. And Sarah says, when he comes, you did what? Now, there is a tradition, guys. There is a tradition. It's not a wide tradition, but it's there in one of the midrashim that Isaac was actually sacrificed. Isaac was actually sacrificed. At the end of the story that we just read, Abraham returns to his servants and they go on together. Doesn't say anything about Isaac. So there's that tradition. There's also a tradition, which you'll see, a little different tradition, that says Sarah was so upset, she had a heart attack and died. She heard about this thing. Read chapter 23. Right, we've read 22, where the sacrifice story occurs. Read 23 now. The first verses. Just two verses. Somebody read them real quick.
Sarah lived to 127 years old. She died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her.
That's it. That's all. Right after the sacrifice story, Sarah dies. And there's a tradition that she died because of this. She died because of this. Heartbroken. Terrified. She couldn't trust. Yes?
Yes, also that Abraham stayed at Beersheba, but it doesn't look like that's where Sarah is. Oh, there's that.
She died.
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's a different problem.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a transportation problem. That's the ferry boat problem. Now, our time is running out. Yes?
Sarah The thing that troubles me is, I guess, the blind obedience that Isaac showed when he hopped up on the woodpile. He was 37
good,
years old.
Good, good, good. Good question. Now,
how many of our kids would do that?
Good, good comment. That's the midrash. Read, now you get to read the midrash, okay?
No glasses.
Oh, no glasses. Okay. All right. But remember what you just said, because I'm going to deal with that right now. And this is the last. This I'm going to and I'm going to show you some of the unique things that Judaism, it may upset you about this, but this is important for us to deal with. Okay? Read the Midrash. R, remember R in this, read the top of the page. R means rabbi. Read it, rabbi. The R is just abbreviation for rabbi.
Another comment. Rabbi Isaac said, when Abraham wished to sacrifice his son Isaac, he said to him, Father, I am a young man and am afraid that my body may tremble through fear of the knife, and I will grieve thee, whereby the slaughter may be rendered unfit, and this will not count as a real sacrifice. Therefore bind me very firmly. Forthwith he bound Isaac. Can one bind a man 37 years old? Another version 26 years old, without his consent.
There's your question. You see, in other words, Isaac knows what's going on. And Isaac says to his father, look, father, well, first of all, the father is 120 years old. Would he have the strength to bind a 36-year-old man? No. So that's your question. And there, so when I say before, you can't think of any problem that no one, that the tradition has not thought about, here's verification of what I'm talking about.
You could give a whole sermon on that.
You could give a whole sermon. In other words, here's a version that Isaac wanted to support his father. Isaac had faith in God, and when God says to Abraham, sacrifice your son, Isaac says, bind me tightly because I may get scared the last minute, and I don't want to get scared, so you bind me, and I'll lie there quietly while you bind me. Okay, that's one quick. Now, that's not a terribly satisfying answer, right? But it's there. You know, it's one version of this thing. In other words, this is all part of it. Now, go ahead, read up, Maya.
Presently, and Abraham stretched forth his hand. He stretched forth his hand to take the knife while the tears streamed from his eyes.
And that's very poignant. Very poignant. That Abraham is, and here's sort of Kierkegaard's answer, that Abraham is following the instructions of God. There are tears in his eyes. He's crying. And, you know, that's, I just put yourself in that position. You're a father, and you're going to have to do this. Okay?
And these tears, prompted by the father's compassion, dropped into Isaac's eyes. Yet even so, his heart rejoiced to obey the will of his creator. The angel assembled in groups above. Why did they cry?
Now, Maya, you're going to have to remember what I said about Midrash. It can start with a very far out passage, and we have no idea what it's saying, and then all of a sudden it becomes clear if we're willing to listen to it. So read the proof text here is a proof text from Isaiah, from the 33rd chapter of Isaiah, and we read it.
The highways lie waste, the wayfaring man ceaseth. He hath broken the covenant. He hath despised the city.
What the heck does that have to do with the sacrifice? You know, what does it have to do with it? Right? What does it have to do with it? Well, you're going to answer it now.
Has he no pleasure in Jerusalem?
There's your answer.
And the temple?
And why is that an answer? We read on.
which he had intended giving as a possession to the descendants.
There you are. Now, hold on for a minute. Let's understand it. And I'm going to shortcut because we're a little short on time. If Isaac is sacrificed, there'll be no covenant with God. There'll be no temple in Jerusalem. It will all be broken. So the angels are up there crying. They're seeing this horrible. They're in as much horror as I am every time I read it. They're worse because they're on the scene. I know it's going to turn out all right. You know, because after 54 years, I have finally learned that the ram is going to intercede and that Isaac will be saved. But if you're up there in the existential moment, the angels are crying because of this terrible thing that's about to happen. Go on, read. There's more.
He regardeth not man. If no merit has stood in Abraham's favor, then no creature has any value.
In other words, if Abraham can't pull this thing out,
What other human being who's one-tenth of the virtue of Abraham can do this? Go ahead.
Rabbi Acha said, Abraham wondered, surely thou too indulgest in prevarication. Yesterday thou saidst, for in Isaac shall seed be called to thee, Genesis 21. Thou didst then retract and say, take now thy son.
In other words, God, you're a liar. Listen, this is strong stuff that the Midrash is saying. God, you promised that in Isaac's seed, in Isaac, the future will be guaranteed. And now God is saying, take your son and offer him as a sacrifice? You see the problem. Okay, go ahead, finish it.
Well, now thou biddest me, lay not thy hand upon the lad, said the Holy One. Blessed be he to him, O Abraham, my covenant will I not profane, from the Psalms. And I will establish my covenant with Isaac, from Genesis. When I bade thee, take now thy son, I will not alter that which is gone out of my lips. Did I tell thee slaughter him?
God says, did I tell you slaughter him? No.
No, but take him up. Thou hast taken him up, now take him down.
Beautiful. You've taken him up, now take him down. And the two went on together. Now, in this tradition, of course, they survived. Now, I'm going to shortcut this because I'm going to say, I think most Christian sources that I've heard deal with this in terms of the conflict between Abraham and Isaac, or Abraham and God, as a matter of individual salvation. How do Jews deal with this passage? Got to understand it. The sacrifice will never take place, but we're always on the edge, always on the verge. The sacrifice is the Jewish people. That's why we read this. You've got to see this. The sacrifice is taken as the upraised arm knife that was in Egypt, in the exile, and in the Nazi concentration camps, that momentary pause between salvation and extermination. And here's this midrash that says, you can't sacrifice Isaac any more than we can be sacrificed. That no matter how scary it is, how terrible it is, God will intervene to save the people. The story of Abraham and Isaac, with all of its horrible implications, its frightening implications, is ultimately not a story of the sacrifice, but a story of the survival of a people. The survival of people. Now, for us, therefore, when I say it's an important thing to understand, it's not the salvation of an individual. It's not the salvation of the individual. But the salvation, can I use the word community here? In this context, I think you'll understand that. That the community has to survive. That somehow or other, the individual people may perish. The values, what the community is saying, has to survive. And this most frightening of stories, imaginable, says somehow or other, ultimately have faith that because of the community, the people will survive. Thank you.